the people come through the project go on to have a role in the community.
Jane, I want to thank you for taking the time to be here this morning.
You're very welcome.
Really appreciate it. Now, I read a little bit about you, the fact that you are doing a lot with refugees, people that are coming here to Japan?
No. Okay, we're supporting refugees overseas.
Overseas, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're also really involved with sustainability, right?
All the projects we support must show sustainability.
Okay.
That's so how it's how you interpret sustainability, of course.
Right. That's true.
Which is always the big topic, and I kind of wonder. So. It's a big buzzword these days.
Isn't it?
But I joined this group in early 2000s and was writing the funding criteria, and sustainability was there. I put it in then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean I'm ahead of everyone, but
now
it just always seemed important.
When was this?
2000s. So
early 2000s, okay.
You know, that was always a factor in our lives. Mm-hmm. It's just become a bigger buzzword since.
Right. Where were you born?
Where?
Yes.
In London.
Okay. Did you live there most of your life?
No, I lived there till I was 3.
And then?
Went south to Sussex.
To Sussex, okay.
Do you know Sussex?
I've heard of Sussex before.
You've heard of Brighton, probably.
Yes.
Okay, well,
yes.
It's not far from Brighton, about, you know, American, so it's about 15 miles.
Okay. Well, you're still in England, so.
No, I was thinking of the miles as opposed to kilometers.
Okay, right. So you lived there until you left?
I lived there until I went to college. So I lived until I was 18.
Right. And you have one sister?
I do.
Younger or older?
Younger.
How many years difference?
3.5.
So you guys weren't close?
Very. We are very close. Very, very different.
That's nice.
Very different and very close.
But you've always been, even when you're growing up?
Yes.
So you took care of her in a way?
Maybe, but I didn't see it like that.
I understand that.
She's a toughie. She had a lot of health
issues.
Well,
you're only 3 years apart, too,
yeah,
but I mean.
She had a lot of health issues. So.
Yeah. Oh, did she?
Well, okay. She had probably what they say these days is this infection you get in hospitals, you know, MMR or something. But at the time, they didn't say it was that, but it lodged in her hip bone, and she had to have a big operation. So she's always had one leg shorter than the other.
Oh, my goodness.
But she joined in everything. She was just so, you know, I can't say I looked after her because she was there and proving she could do it. She's
what kind of child were you, more academic or were you more sports minded as a child?
I'm more academic than my sister. My sister is not very academic.
So you compared to her?
Yes. my mother was awful. She'd just say things like, "Oh, Jane knows everything," which shut me up. So I didn't want to say anything, you know. So I was very shy.
Okay. And that's because of the way your mother was talking to you as a child?
I'm sure that a lot of the shyness was due to my mother. I don't think she was oppressive or nasty or anything at all.
Yes.
Or maybe I was just naturally shy. I don't know. Not anymore.
Is she still with us?
No.
She's passed.
She passed away 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I don't know.
And your father?
She was 93. He died very young. He died when he was 62.
Okay. Were you already in Japan when he died?
No. I saw him. I was there in the hospital when he died.
But I mean, had you already moved to Japan?
No.
You hadn't at all?
No. Okay. I'd planned a visit, so he knew I was visiting, but that was all. I mean, I only planned a visit, that's all. I didn't plan to come and live here.
Okay.
But lots of people say that, don't they?
Isn't that the truth? It's kind of like Hawaii.
Probably.
People go there and say, "I'll just go see it, it's all this hoo-ha," and they never leave.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
how Japan is, I think. Particularly, I don't know, other places. I can only speak for Tokyo. I found very, very interesting. But let's go through this. So when you were in school, what kind of subjects did you like to get involved with?
At high school.
Yes.
I liked English and I liked the sciences, but I was very good at maths. We have plural maths in England, you know that.
Right. No, we only have math.
I know.
So you like to compare the two. Okay.
How
you
do things evolve? No, I think it's very interesting how things evolve. Anyway,
it's true.
Anyway, I was good at that subject, and although I enjoyed English, I got terrible grades, and I got great grades for my maths. So, I was quite happy with most of the subjects, really.
Okay. But anything that you really focused in on? Because you went to college as well, right?
I then went to college. Yes. And I studied, it was called institutional management, which sounds pretty awful, doesn't it, to go to an institution. But right. It was basically hospitality management.
Okay. Did you go to a public school or private school for high school? Because it's opposite for the U.S.
Yes. In Britain, I went to a state school.
A state school. Mm. Okay.
Public school are the Eatons. We have a
right,
funny
of course.
Phrasing
yes, I know.
In Britain.
You
I know it's those, very complicated.
You call those public schools.
Yes.
They're, right, but they're really private. We call them private.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, they're just posh private.
Yeah. Because like the Eatons are the schools that you actually have to, I think, apply for while you're pregnant, I've heard.
Well, some people, yes. Not everybody, but yes. Right. I think that's what some people do, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but no, I went to a state school.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy it? Was it co-ed, of course?
It was co-ed, and I enjoyed it, yes. I enjoyed it particularly in the last 2 years as I found my voice.
Which was?
Well, just because I've been shy, as I said.
Okay.
I got into the sixth form, and we
What do you call that?
We call it the sixth form, the last 2 years of school. I don't know if they still do, actually.
Okay, sixth form.
Yes, well, you've got what, first form, second form, third form, right? And fifth form is when you're 15, 16.
Okay.
Then you go into the last 2 years and you've got the sixth form.
I've never heard that before.
Really?
No, I've never heard that. 'Cause
that's interesting.
In the U.S., we have, in elementary, it's first was kindergarten through sixth grade, and then junior high, when I went to school, was 7th through 9th, and then high school was 10th through 12th.
Yes, I know. And yeah. I'm getting used to that as
but
I
they don't have
talk
that now.
To people here. Oh, really?
No,
oh,
they
okay.
don't do that any longer, because they have elementary, I think, is 1st through 7th, and they don't, I don't know if they call it middle school or something. They don't have a middle school. I think they go from 8th to 12th or something like that.
In UK now, I think they have, different schools have different systems, so they might mm-hmm. split it in the middle school, which we think of in Japan. And I can't say what they call them now. When I'm talking to my sister and niece, they've gone up into high school, but they don't talk about, we don't talk so much about years
okay.
and forms.
Forms.
So anyway, when I went to the last 2 years of school, we have less subjects, as I think most schools do, and we had debating society.
And you liked that.
And I learnt to talk. It was great because I could talk about things with nothing to do with me. And that was what I really enjoyed that, and I found my voice. And
okay.
I've been talking ever since.
And that led you into college. When you went into college, what did you major in?
I majored hospitality management. So basically, it was a really good course. It wasn't a degree course. I don't have a degree.
Okay.
And again, people go, oh, you don't have a degree.
Wait, you can go to college and not get a degree. You mean it's a two-year college?
It was a three-year college, but it was called a higher national diploma.
Okay.
It would be a degree.
Right.
But it wasn't then. But it was a great course because I studied everything. Management, accounting, bookkeeping, accounting, staff psychology and that kind of thing, as well as food and housekeeping because it was hospitality management. But along with that came the sciences. So we did food chemistry, physical science, like, you know, why does that floor polish when you use that product, you know, so you're talking about that. And then biology as it affects the, you know, food consumption and so on. A lot of different subjects, and I loved it all. It was a really good course. I was an active student. I loved the marches and the debates and the,
wait, the marches
representations.
And the debates. But that was that? What years are we talking
about? CND, 1970.
Okay, that would have been my time. Wait, just a minute, let me just think for a second.
Well, it was Vietnam.
Vietnam, that's right.
I
so
mean,
those are the marches you're talking about, right?
We didn't have the same Vietnam marches in the same way, but CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament,
okay,
was
right.
definitely quite a few of the marches.
And also the younger people against the established system, the way it was. That was a worldwide phenomenon because it was happening here in Japan as well.
It was great, yes.
Yes,
great.
It was happening all over.
My favorite one was, this is very British.
Okay.
At the time, Margaret Thatcher was the Education Secretary. and she was taking away school milk because schools had a small bottle of milk. The state schools had a small bottle of milk every day. And so my favourite march was Thatcher, Thatcher, the milk snatcher. It was a serious one, but I think it's funnier than the others. C&D was pretty serious, and so on. So, yes, I was totally caught up with learning to be a student and learning about life and all the things that go with it. And we saw it as a time of great change, as I'm sure the same in the States and so on, and that it was leading to a more caring society.
Yes.
So that was all, I think, quite exciting. I'm pleased I was brought up in that time. Mm-hmm. I think there are other great times, but I think that was fun, adventurous, maturing. I was maturing and so on, and it was a time of great learning. And so I got to the end of college and I hadn't got a job because I hadn't applied myself to it. Just covered myself with occasional jobs for the next year, and was fortunate enough to one of those occasional jobs. I was in an accounting company, and he learnt that I'd got a diploma and I'd done bookkeeping. So he actually employed me for the next 9 months on incomplete records, which is a very good experience for me because I went out to different companies to go through their basic books and turn those into accounts. So that was a good experience. And during this time, I thought, I really want to go overseas. I don't know if that's what I want to do long term, but I'd like to know now. And so I was trying to get some kind of opportunity overseas. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I got a placement with what's called Voluntary Service Overseas, VSO. It's the British equivalent of the Peace Corps.
Okay.
At that and time, right. I was posted to Zambia, where I was for the next 3.5 years.
At the age of about, what, 20?
21,
maybe?
22.
Okay.
22, 23. I loved it, absolutely loved it.
What did you love about it?
I loved learning a new country, learning about a new country, the culture, the landscape, the people, and the work. It was totally different.
That was a very interesting time. I was drafted, so I enlisted into the Air Force to avoid Vietnam.
I was going to say, you avoided Vietnam, did you?
I was hoping to avoid it, and then ironically, my last year and 4 months, they had a calling for Vietnam in my career field, so I put in for Vietnam because I hadn't been outside the continental United States, and I figured, you're taking 4 years out of my life. Yeah. You're going to send me somewhere. So they sent me to Japan. That's how I came here.
Right.
That's how I came here. And then I came here and I said, I can't wait to get there because I'm going to teach those people with those rickshaws and those grass hats a little what it's like to be in a modern society.
Yes.
I remember coming in the plane. I never forget. We flew in. And we came in. I saw these little trucks and little cars on the road. And when I landed, there were still little trucks and little cars. They didn't really change in size. But everything was modern. People got in proper queues. They had taxis that had automatic doors.
Oh, already? That's
that has always been.
Right, that's interesting.
That's always been. I don't know when it started, but it was in the 70s for sure. Mm-hmm. I came here in 74. But just many things that were just
10 years before me. So yes, that's not that surprising.
Oh, okay. My goodness. And I just couldn't believe. And then I went to Akihabara. Every store had the same thing. And I said, how are all these stores staying in business? They had equipment I had never seen before. Stereo equipment and cameras and all kind of things. And everybody was nice. And I just could not get over it. And I said, somebody lied to me. This is not what I was expecting.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That is interesting because I do remember when I first came that the first day everything was strange. But after that, I just kept noticing the things that were similar.
Right. We're going to get into that because that's the part of the
story. Same
as
what you were finding, yeah.
I just thought I'd tell you that. I don't know if I'll put that in or not, my part, but right. I just wanted to share that with you because that's the part I want to get into, how we feel about Japan. So anyway, so you went to Africa, Zambia.
Zambia, yes.
Okay. And you were there for 3 years?
Yeah, just a bit more than 3 years, yeah.
You didn't get sick or anything during that time?
No.
Okay, because a lot of people, when they take go away,
I know,
they get...
Yes.
You know, no, not only homesick, I mean they get sick.
Yeah. No, I loved it.
Okay, when you came back, what did you do? What did that...
I got a job in... I was unemployed for a few months. I went on what we call the dole.
Okay.
That's the unemployment benefit. And then I got a job in a large department store called John Lewis. And I was the restaurant manager. It was opening. It was a new store that was opening in a new town. And I was in charge of the staff catering. And then I went to the restaurant. And excellent company to work for. Really, really good.
They still exist?
Yes, they're a big company, very big company.
Okay.
And it's a partnership. So everyone who was employed by them was a partner. And so we'd all get the bonuses at the year end and so on. And that was established by the founder. I'm just reading now that things are changing on that, unfortunately.
Okay, well, they're not, you're no longer a partner, you're just...
Yeah, they're removing those benefits. But I'm not sure where they're at with the decisions on it. But no, it's very good. And it's a department store as well as big supermarket chain called Waitrose. And I worked with them for 5 years.
Doing what?
As a restaurant manager.
Restaurant manager, okay.
It was a 250-seat restaurant with 50 staff. And I was, 30-something, I forget now. Yeah. But that wasn't so unusual. When I came to Japan, I realized how unusual that was, because people were quite shocked at my age to be in charge of a number of people.
Right.
Because that's not the sort of opportunities you had in Japan.
Right. So right after that job, you came to Japan?
Yes.
By yourself?
I came by myself. I came to see a friend. I just split up from my first husband. And was looking to travel.
So you were married for how long during the time you were working as a manager? All of the time?
For 5 years, yeah.
Okay, did he work there as well?
No, he worked nearby.
You said he worked in Dubai?
He worked nearby, sorry.
Oh, nearby. I thought you said in Dubai.
In the same town.
What? That's why it took me a while. Okay, so you worked nearby. You guys were married for a short while, and then you decided, I'm going off to Japan. I'm leaving you and I'm going to Japan.
Yeah, no, I'd known him a long time and we'd been together a long time.
Okay, and you told me you're very close friends now.
We're very close friends now.
Well, that's beautiful.
No. Obviously, it took a little bit of adjustment, but no, very, very good friends now. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking to go, that was the reason. You know, I was restless and I wanted to go overseas again. And so I heard from a friend in Japan, oh, great, I'll go and see what that's like. It's different from Africa. And so I came on a 4-week holiday, maybe 3 weeks, but I came on a holiday here. It was February.
To where?
1984, Tokyo.
Oh, you came to Tokyo, okay.
Yes. It was just an amazing, I think it was 3 weeks, sorry. It was amazing 3 weeks, and it was the heaviest snowfall they'd had in 40 years.
What year was it?
84.
84, okay, 10 years after I came here.
February 84.
It used to snow here. People don't realize that. After the little snow we got now and we've had for a couple of decades now,
yeah,
it used to snow so bad that, I mean, you really had to. I had a little 2-cylinder truck, a Daihatsu, because I didn't like to follow the crowd, and everybody was getting these sports cars and everything else. So when I first came in the service, I bought this two little Keijiro, should they call them.
Yes.
2 cylinders right beside me. If I got caught in the snow, I could actually pick up the back end, move it around.
Right.
I loved it. And it smoked all over the place. It just burned oil.
Are you still in the military at this point?
I was still in the military, first 2 years. Right, yeah. Right. 74 to 76. Mm. I just loved it. It was just something new. I liked it being here.
Yeah.
So anyway, so you came here in 84.
In 84.
And what did you do when you got here?
Well, I traveled around, apart from being in, obviously that was my center was Tokyo, but I went to Kyoto, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, you know, all the tourist things. In that short time I was here, I wanted to see those places. Also, I wanted to go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki because I'd been on these marches as a student, and so obviously they were therefore topical. I see them in a completely different light, having been here. you know, obviously the reaction is, you know, no nuclear war and so on. And I still think that. But I saw it from a slightly different angle as to why it had happened. And, you know, who knows whether it was right or wrong.
What's your angle? Would you see it from?
Yeah. Well, there was a comment in the visitor's book that, you know, that this shouldn't happen. This should never have happened. And one of the comments was, this should never have been made to happen. And I'm not putting that as my view on it, but it helps to see things in proportion as to why they happened. I don't think nuclear is a good idea at all, and I don't think it was a good idea. But to look at it in a different perspective, I think, is always a valuable thing to do.
Okay, I still don't understand what perspective you see it in. The different perspective you see it in. You see it's a bad thing to do and everything else, but what's the other perspective?
I don't have an overall judgment on whether America was right or wrong to drop it, except that, of course, I think it's wrong to drop a nuclear bomb.
Okay.
But, you know, finger-pointing is a very difficult thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to draw me anymore on that.
Okay, all right. I look at it this way. I think that either way, being an American, I don't like to, I'm at the age now where I don't think it's really a racial, ethical, sexual decision we're making. It's a human one. If we all looked the same way, whoever built that first would have dropped it first.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying that's all. I don't think it matters. If the Japanese built it first, I think they would have dropped it first. If the Germans, they would have dropped it. I don't care. I think we would have shown who has the biggest stick, and that's what we do as human beings. We understand it in the animal kingdom, but we think that we're not animals. That's what we are first, and we're going to show, I can do this.
I mean, you know, from my work as well, I just, all conflict, I'm not into it, of course nobody's into it. I don't like it. And so therefore, of course, I didn't like the nuclear bomb.
Right.
But I didn't like what happened in the World War II and, you know, so
all
on
the time,
and so
forth. World War
so
One.
It goes on, exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
I'm saying, but I don't know that we're, I hope, anyway, let's get back to you.
So, yes.
So what was your feeling about Japan when you came here? What did you think? Well, you've been here for how long now?
40 years.
Okay, so I've been here 10 years. So when you came, you were like me. You came here and you said, I'm going to go back someday.
Well, I came here on that holiday and decided that for the time being, I would come back for a while. It was bubble time.
Tell me about it.
There was plenty of opportunities. While I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, I could work here. That's exactly what I did. I came back in the June of that year, and I went home to work my notice, came back in the June of that year, and just spent the first few years teaching English.
Making good money.
But it was awful, wasn't it? It was disgusting what we were doing. You know, at least I tried to put some structure into my classes just to redeem myself in English views, but I think we were all using the situation. And of course the students liked it, that they wouldn't have come if they didn't want to do it, so it wasn't a complete abuse. But, I mean, it was people just having English classes in coffee shops, charging a lot of money, without any structure at all. But, interesting.
Do you think that stopped?
it has, to the extent that it was happening in the 80s.
Because I still see people doing it.
Yes, of course, they're still doing it. But they can't charge quite what we
no,
were
they
doing.
No, they can't.
Oh, my. And the other thing, of course, because it was bubble time, I was horrified at the waste.
Such as?
Well, I think I didn't quite, but I like to say I furnished my first apartment from the rubbish dump.
Which was really good things, right?
Because everything that was good was being thrown out. I did pick up an awful lot from, and a lot of people I speak to who were here then, it's the same. And, you know, people didn't get things repaired, which, you know, we are post-war babies, right? So therefore we grew up with our parents taking care and making sure things were repaired. So I was, shocked, I think is wrong, but certainly unhappier to see how much waste there was. And then the bubble burst.
It did. So what happened then? What did you do? How do you see Japan? Because your husband's not Japanese. Your husband's English.
Yes.
He's British like you.
Yes, yes.
And so was your first.
Yes.
Okay. And how long were you here before you got married the second time?
2 years.
So you've been married 38 years.
Yes.
To your present husband.
Yes.
My.
Thank
goodness.
You for reminding me of that.
Well, yeah, it happened. I can put the numbers together. You were in accounting, but I mean, I can put these numbers together.
It's what you think about, isn't it? Yeah. Yes.
And that's interesting. So why did you not fall into the trap that a lot of foreigners fall into, marrying someone local?
That's not a trap.
I shouldn't say trap. I shouldn't even call it. You're right. Correct me on that. Why didn't you fall into to form like?
Because
most
I already
do?
Knew him before I came.
Really?
So he was the friend who was here, and we had met in Zambia. And so I just kept contact with him. We're like lots of friends from Zambia. And so he had written to say he'd moved to Japan. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And that was why I came, you know, I had somebody to see, to visit. Mm-hmm. And so that friend became more than a friend. So that was, I don't know, that's why I didn't marry a Japanese, but that was how I came to marry to a Brit.
Because I find so many people come over here and they get really fascinated with the people here, just as you go to Zambia, people get involved in the Zambians. So what was your time like here? What was your experience?
Well, I realized in those first couple of years that I wasn't born to be an English teacher.
Okay.
some of the classes were quite interesting, but I just was hopeless. Like going to a class of the freshmen, and you've got 25 students there, and so you're trying to get some conversation out of them. What did you do at the weekend? I went shopping, or you know, and I just didn't have the ability to get them to talk more. And so after a couple of years, we were both thinking about what should we do, and having both done overseas work, voluntary work, development work, we thought, well, either we'll go and look for something again in that sector, or if we're going to stay in Japan, we must do something more concrete. And that decision was not as quick as I've made it sound now. But in the end, we opened a restaurant.
What type of restaurant?
British restaurant.
Where?
Nakameguro.
What's the name of it?
1066.
1066. There was a restaurant. Do you play Irish music there too? Is it a band as well?
We had twice a month.
Right by the station.
Not far from the station, and that music on Wednesday twice a month. It was a real sort of jam session. Anyone could come along.
And one woman was playing the spoons once, right?
Yes, that was Doreen.
And Doreen, she comes over to me, Irish woman. I was there. I thought you looked familiar. I said, I saw you there, because you sure enough were there.
Well, yes.
Yes. But anyway, so I was sitting in there, and I'd had something to eat, and I was the only person of color in there, and she's playing the spoons, and everybody else was jamming. And she comes over to me, she says, well, you don't look quite Irish. And I said, I said, you may not believe this, but my great grandmother was German-Irish.
How interesting.
And I said, you guys went everywhere. and the Irish are the blacks of England, so come on now. Yes. And she laughed, and she came over. She came right over to me to speak. She was playing this one.
Doreen Simmons, she was a legend in Japan.
Really?
Yeah, she died about 3 or 4 years ago.
I wish I had known.
She died a bit more than that, I think. But you often lose track of how long you
sleep. Don't, isn't that the truth?
But she did a lot of, she became a sumo expert, and she did a lot of commentaries on the Zoom.
Right. Yes, and you have all these pictures with her beside these massive guys.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Tiny woman she was.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, and she played the spoons, and she also played this baran, Irish drum.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, that was us. That was 1066.
That is beautiful. See, we really are close, but it gets lost and not in the translation, and just the fact that there's so many things going on.
Yes.
And no one's really trying to document this and getting this.
And there wasn't so much going on then, was there? Because that jam session, the reason that people come along, there weren't the places to go out and just, you know, play if you weren't professionals. And some of them went on to be professional and others drifted on to somewhere else. But
that's
right. It was great.
Wow. Do you play any instruments yourself?
No, no. I'm very
unmusical. What about your husband?
He has, and we have a beautiful double bass at home, which he was going to play, and he just seems to be more decorative these days.
So you still have the restaurant, 1066?
No, we closed it in 2000.
Okay.
We did it for 12 years, which was...
Right. So what are you doing now?
I am running an organization called Refugee Empowerment International.
Okay. Which does?
Supports projects for refugees and IDPs, internally displaced people, in different countries. We're currently supporting projects in Thailand, Myanmar, Lebanon, and Kenya.
Have you been to all those places?
Yes.
Yeah.
And more.
Okay. So, when made you decide to start doing this? And is it both of you?
No, just
okay,
me.
Okay, just you.
You mean my husband? No,
yes.
No. We ran the restaurant together, but... When we had the restaurant, we continued our work in the community, if you like. How can you say that? So we had an involvement with a small Sri Lankan community group supporting a school in Sri Lanka. And we also opened up the restaurant for NGO opportunities, MPO opportunities, parties and so on. So we kept our involvement in community support, social issues, whatever. When we closed the restaurant, a couple of friends of mine who were in the organization, which was called RIJ then, it's now REI, they asked me to join them. And I at first said no because I'd seen their very big, very good, fancy events and I thought that wasn't my style. But they wanted somebody to monitor the projects, to choose the projects, monitor the projects and report on them. And that was right up my street. That was totally up my street. And so that's how I came to join them.
So what is it that you do outside of raising funds for these refugees? What do you do? I mean, when you raise the funds, then what happens? Where do the funds go? To do what?
They go to the communities. Our model is very much a hand up, not a hand out. And this is something that we have developed strongly over the years. When I first joined REI, I didn't have specific knowledge of the refugee issues. I mean, I did from interest and reading about it, but I hadn't got direct experience. So I picked up the projects and the reports and so on. And when, for example, when I was on holiday in Thailand, I'd arrange it that we went to the border area with Myanmar. It was Burma then. And we'd meet people working in that community and refugees themselves. And I began to see the more successful ones, the ones which have more impact and ongoing impact, and the ones that, the word that you want to pick up is sustainable. So the ones that were going beyond the project. And I realized that that was really the most important thing to consider. Mm. That yes, to give support for this year to somebody is important, but it's not important for the long term. It doesn't take people into the future.
Now I'm still having trouble. These refugees are from the very country that you're going to. They're in that country. The refugees in that country?
If it's Thailand, they're refugees from Myanmar.
Myanmar, okay. And if it's Myanmar?
If it's Myanmar, they're internally displaced.
Internally displaced, right? Are most of the countries internally misplaced people?
These days, yes. The statistics,
country.
There are more people who are internally displaced,
right,
IDPs
internally
we call
displaced,
them.
Right.
There are more people who are IDPs than refugees.
And that's in all countries, right? Even
that's
America?
All over the world, because right. it's quite a burden on a country, because most of them are fleeing to the less developed countries, and therefore the burden on that country to provide the education, health, and so on. It's a lot. So it's less easy for people to flee over borders than it was.
Right.
And so more people are now internally displaced, but their challenges are just the same.
Mm-hmm.
They're still within their sovereign government, so obviously that is slightly different from the point of view of being stateless or not. But in terms of what they want to do to rebuild their lives, they're in the same position.
Right.
And very much what we're looking at is providing funds that will support the community to support itself.
Okay.
So when I say a hand up,
right.
Our funding is giving them the chance to build for themselves.
Okay. See, still, I'm wondering how it can be distributed to everyone, because let's say there's a bunch of people in this room and we're all displaced. Who gets the funds? How do you decide it? How do they organize themselves in order to distribute it, or is it just the strongest guy gets all the money?
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
How do you set that up? How can you be sure that's going to take place?
It's a very good question, and it's a question that more people should ask.
Yeah.
More people.
Can you explain it to me?
We can't fund them all.
Right.
There's absolutely no doubt about that, and we're a very small organization. We know that basically they have to apply to us, and whoever they are, we'll come to that in a minute. The group or the organization has to apply to us and show what they want to do, explain what they want to do, how they're going to do it, what resources they've got, and what the outcome will be.
Okay.
And then we will look at that application and assess whether it's meeting our criteria, the number of people, the people involved. Is it involving the refugee community? Is it taking into consideration the host community, who also are put upon? And most importantly, where it's leading to, what will happen after that. And that is the most important part of the project, that basically we want to invest our funds in the future. We are investing in human potential. I know it sounds very grand.
I know, I understand.
But it is. The people in those communities have the skills and talents. Just because they've been displaced from their homes doesn't mean that they don't have skills and talents. It's not this myth of this great displaced, uneducated, poor group of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who've lost things with no choice of their own.
That's right.
But what they want to do is rebuild and have a future for themselves. And the most important part of this, well, another important part of this, is that the majority of them want to stay within their culture. They don't want to move to other places. And so in the big picture of things, they get forgotten. Because people get upset about asylum seekers and groups of people moving around. Whereas actually the majority of people are not doing that, and they just get forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
So we are very much targeting the communities who are staying near home.
Mm.
And I can prove that this is true, because the statistics that give now about 110 million people are displaced from their homes. This is
worldwide.
Yeah, worldwide. And this is through conflict, persecution, mm-hmm. And so on. Of that number, 3.5 million, approximately, are seeking asylum. It's not even 10%. So the majority of people are not seeking asylum. And of course, internationally, globally on the media, it gets confused with migrants and refugees and, so migrants are people who are choosing to move. I'm very passionate about this.
You should be.
And refugees have not chosen to move, but
right.
They had to.
And that's the difference, okay. I still see this being a real nightmare as far as trying to keep records as to who's getting what and how they get it and how they're achieving whatever goals you place upon them to get more, or so they can go there. You see what I'm saying?
No, it is a nightmare. And for the big organizations, it's very hard for them to do. I mean, for the big organizations, their bureaucracy is huge. I mean, they do have their place. They do have their place, and it's very much a macro management, if you like, whereas we're looking at micro. And because we are small, we can get up close and personal to the projects. And so we go and visit.
On what kind of basis? Let's say you give funds to a place, wherever it may be, you give funds to the place. How often do you come back to check to see what's happened as a result?
Well, currently, every other, well, not currently, because COVID interrupted right. that travel and so on. But we would aim to get there every other year, or certainly within 3 years. We haven't been to Lebanon for a while. It's not probably great to go there at the moment. Mm-hmm. But the important thing of when we go and visit is not only to look at they are small groups. I mean, you know, like one project will reach maybe 1,000 people, another project is only 90 in that year. And we will look, obviously, at what they're doing. We receive reports, of course. And then we will look at their books. And they're very immaculate, these books, very impressive. And how that reflects on what's going on. But what we also want to do is meet people who have graduated, if you like, to lack of any other word, from the previous projects and what they're doing now. And that is our important message, that the people come through the project, go on to have a role in the community. So not only have they benefited themselves, but they're obviously benefiting their family, but they're benefiting the wider community. So be it a health support, that there's a maternal health training project that we support. Those mothers who receive that training will talk to their peers and the other people in their community, and they will spread, and people will see that their children are healthier and so on. So that will spread. The ripple effect is what we're looking for. Another group, the students are learning human rights, leadership, care of the environment. And they go on to work in committees in the camp, within the camp, to make sure that the conditions for people in the camp are better. And quite a lot of them go back into inside Myanmar to their villages to work with the people in the village to say, we don't have to accept this. We can make things better for ourselves. We can improve the conditions for our people. And I see it as if the funds, not us, because there's no point in us strengthening it because we're not there, and that if we can support people who will become stronger, that they will be stronger in the face of future incursions.
Do you get involved with other small organizations like your own that are doing the same thing?
Not especially.
Couldn't there sometimes be an overlap?
And well, yes.
You could be played. I mean, when I say played, I mean, you have one guy come up to you and his paperwork is immaculate, and then he goes to another organization doing the same thing.
Well, and that happens within the project.
I would think so.
Yes, it does happen within the project.
So how would you know? You wouldn't know.
Well, they tell us when we go and visit. But we don't know if it's happened anywhere.
Right, yeah. Of course. Yeah.
But that is where you can rely on the fact the ripple effect will happen.
Okay.
Because it's human nature to share and to... and particularly if it's making things better within a community that's had trauma and problems within it. So, it's the impact is magic. It really is.
You've seen it take a place?
I've seen it, and I've seen what people, and how proud they are of having a role in the community. I mean, people who've lost their self-respect, you know, because they've lost so much, they just want to feel a little bit better about themselves. And the fact they can then see it's affecting others. I mean, we all kind of like that.
That's true. What do you think? Do you think Japan does a good job with its people that way? Oh, wait, why did you kind of go blank on me when you asked that question? Wait, so, see, this is going to take too much time, I think.
It's a huge question.
It is.
It is a huge question. And, I mean, is Japan allowing its people or... I mean, who is the people? That's why I went blank on you.
Okay, right.
The question was
which
rather
people am
a big
I talking
one.
About? Right.
Yes.
Right. Well, I'm not talking about the ones with the blue tint. I'm thinking about. I'm not talking about the blue tint people. I'm thinking about the people that you see. They overdo it when they have like road construction. they have five people when you could have had one electronic arm going like this.
Yes.
Parking areas.
Yes.
They know how to place the people. And I think they give them a purpose. And they get up and put on the uniforms and get out and do what they have to do. Same thing we see with cab companies. When we came here, you came in 84, when I came in 74, you had to really put up your arm. Now, anybody's arm that goes above their heart, a cab will stop by. You know, you don't have to put up your hands.
Yeah.
And they'll come, they'll stop anywhere. It's not just somewhere. Before, when we came, they had certain places they wouldn't go, and they would never stop on a corner, and they'd say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to come down here. There were different rules. And now, oh, but anyway.
But the rule, the rule word is interesting, because I have this, you know, we are an NGO, MPO, whatever you like to call us, in a country which is not known for its charitable work. It's not in the psyche. And there's a lot of things we could discuss on why, but one of the issues, you talked about rules then. The way I look at this is that Japan is a rule-based society, but we come from a moral-based society. I know it's a very broad thing to say, but it does influence how we would view things.
Right. I think they did something that no one else in modern society or any society that I'm familiar with has ever done. They blocked themselves off for over 200 years.
Yeah.
And during that time, they weren't holding hands singing Kumbaya. They were basically getting rid of the weak ones. They were doing what human beings will do. That's what I'm saying. It's not that. They made sure they cleansed this whole island and made sure everyone understood. Now we're going to call ourselves Japanese. And that's what happened, no matter what they look like. Because they're the most diverse Asian-looking people I've ever seen. If you go to China, there's a commonality there. Korea, certain areas, Myanmar, it doesn't matter where you go. The people look somewhat similar. Here, if you really look at them, such a diversity.
But we also see that difference because we've been here a while. And we can see the differences, yes.
But they got everyone to comply. When we first came here, you better not have brown hair.
Well, yes,
and be Japanese.
Right. And I was just going to say that we have seen changes in Japan.
We have,
in terms of a more sort of liberal approach to life, which is very nice.
But I think it's
nice for the individuals that we particularly know as well.
So. I think for us, we can see those changes. But the truth is, if you're Japanese, if you've gone through their elementary school, from elementary to sixth grade, that's where you become Japanese.
Yeah.
That's where they make their Japanese. If you come here after that, you're never going to be Japanese. Not in the true sense of the word.
We have a lot of interns working with us, and quite a few of them are, they're all nationalities, I have to say. But often we will have work with Japanese who are returnees, and we hear about their experiences in schools, and they vary. It varies on the school very much. So.
That's a topic I'm going to start to get more in depth with when I talk to people. We don't have the time right now with you because you're...
It's not my expertise either, necessarily.
But your expertise is refugees, and that was really good because I had never thought of it the way that you were, you know, bringing it out. I hadn't really thought of it at all. I thought of refugees. And I don't think people understand what asylum seekers are.
No, they don't.
Okay, then what are they? Tell me real quick.
Asylum seekers are seeking the right to stay in another country for safety as a citizen of that country.
Right. They've heard the term, but people haven't looked into it
to
find out what the definition
is.
Right.
But it goes beyond just the safety. They want to have the right to stay there.
Right. And I think you made it very clear. Refugees, most don't want to leave their country.
No, they
want to stay where they're at. And I used to,
they can teach us so much.
That's true.
They do. They truly inspire me when I go and visit. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds sort of
humans. You're looking at human beings who are dealing with a different facet of life,
yeah.
One that you didn't choose to follow, but you're going into it to see if you can help to make their lives a little bit better. But
they
that's
make
their
my
journey.
Lives better.
Well, it does.
Life better.
It does. Because you start to appreciate more of what you really have access to.
Yeah.
And don't take it for granted,
yes.
As most of us do.
Mm. They are truly amazing.
Jane, I'm going to ask you this question that I ask everyone at the end of the podcast. If you could go back in time and meet the younger Jane and give her advice based upon what you know now, how old would she be and what advice would you give her?
I don't think I have any advice. Maybe don't be quite so, I don't know. I think if I was younger, I would say don't try to be so extreme or different. But I've enjoyed being different. So, you know, if you were younger, you'd say, no, don't, you know, toe the line and go your own way. But I would never have done that then, and why should I look back and say I should do it?
So basically,
I don't have any strong regrets. I mean, there's things I'd have done differently, obviously, but I don't have any strong regrets, except maybe things I said to people or, you know, I acted on an occasion. So therefore, I'm not sure that I would change the advice. I didn't have any advice.
That's not bad. I think that's quite good. I think what you're saying, like you said, you have no regrets and not having any. If you had changed something, you wouldn't be where you are now.
Exactly. And I just love the opportunities I've had. And so I'd be advising anyone else to say, if you have opportunities and you want to use them, make the most of them. And I say that to the interns who come to work with us. If you don't make the most of this opportunity, you're the loser, not, you know, and it's a shame. But no, I've loved the opportunities I've had. Of course, there's some I'd like more. I'd like more travel. But, you know, equally, I'm sort of a big thing on the environment, so perhaps I shouldn't be doing lots more travel, you know, but that be that as it may.
That's right. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so, so much. I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. And never forget, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.